Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. Conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. So we're here today with Asfandar Mir. He's currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford. Asfandar, thank you for being here, and welcome to Raiders of the Lost Archive.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Jesse, Christian. Looking forward to the conversation.
Definitely.
So just to give everyone a little background, initially, what was the topic that you were interested in for the research project that you went to the field, which for you is Pakistan, to collect data on?
Sure. So this was early in grad school. I went to grad school at the University of Chicago. And from the outset, I was interested in the question of effects of counterinsurgency and U.S. counterterrorism violence, which were extremely salient in those days. ISIS had started taking territory in parts of Iraq and Syria, and the U.S. drone war in Pakistan had gone on for some time, and there was a lot of public debate around it. And early in grad school, I read the U.S. counterinsurgency field manual and the narrative surrounding it. And there was a lot of work coming online at the time, formally theorizing the counterinsurgency narrative, the importance of population security as a means, as a strategy to attain efficacious outcomes. But the closer I looked, the more unsatisfied I became. And from the sources I was seeing, my empirical knowledge at the time, which was growing, it appeared to me that the focus on civilian protection as the fundamental driver of conflict processes was a little off. And the other extreme, which the literature was offering, it centered on total brutalization of civilian populations, also presented puzzles on the cases of U.S. campaigning as well as South Asian counterinsurgency violence that I was interested in. So it was from that place that I started building, crafting my project, and I felt that I had to do some kind of field work to mobilize high fidelity data to inform my work.
Why did you pick the country that you did?
So I was born in Pakistan. I went to school there before coming to the U.S. for college. So in that sense, it was it was home territory. There was also an absence of empirical literature on that case, on that very important case, from a policy angle, as well as in the scholarly literature. There were some major gaps, and I thought that there was an opportunity for a contribution there.
Good deal. Yeah, I think we should probably ask that question a little bit more consistently. I'm very curious as to kind of like what leads people to do the things that they do. But as you were going, what did people tell you when you were going into the field, which in this context was kind of like home, right? But still the field.
For sure. So at the University of Chicago, fieldwork was certainly valued, and the socialization environment placed fieldwork at the top of the methodological sort of hierarchy. I worked with Paul Stanland, who expected his students to answer questions with lots of ground knowledge. Lisa Vadeen was in the department, and her work on Syria sort of loomed large in like all conversations related to conflict and authoritarianism. Ben Lessing was starting out, and he had written a terrific dissertation. And even John Mearsheimer, who ended up being my chair, he hadn't done any field work but he had the spirit where he wanted students to address the troubling world out there with actual insight. So University of Chicago encouraged me. But at my dissertation hearing, I got more or less three main messages, which were interesting and which were a little disturbing as well. And, you know, and they were disturbing because of how blunt my committee ended up being. The first one said, don't hurt others in the field, not civilians and not even people in power. And, I didn't fully understand it at the time. But that was the first message. The other was, I won't name the person on the committee who said it sort of point blank. He said, "Don't get killed." Like you yourself.
Always good advice.
Yeah. It was. I mean, it hit me at that time that this was something that I had to keep in mind. I owed my committee and. And the final point they made was that don't overcommit to the interlocutors you interact in the field for access.
Yeah.
And again, this was not something that I fully understood what it meant and where would I be overcommitting for access? Like, what does that even mean? They try to explain it to me and, I got a little bit of it, but it really didn't sink in until I was in the field. But those were the messages I got, and in addition to other methodological and research design related guidance.
Well, I'd like you to follow up on that a little bit. I mean, when you say that you had epiphanies later in the field, that can take a lot of forms. So be more specific.
Yeah, so once I was in the field, and the field ended up being in fact two countries. So much of what I did was in Pakistan, and then part of the work for this project took place in the U.S. in Washington, and this was because there were four bubbles. Of interlocutors that I was trying to work in order to answer the question of the effects of U.S. drone war and Pakistani counterinsurgency violence. The first one was the set of Pakistani officials who either cooperated or blocked the U.S. counterterrorism campaign. And this group was dotted by, intelligence types, military officials, it was extremely sort of secretive, and it was hard to locate. Just identifying these interlocutors was fairly challenging. Then the second group in Pakistan that I tried to work were the targets of the U.S. And Pakistani campaigning, which were members of. The Pakistani insurgent group, the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, as well as some members of the international terror group, Al-Qaeda. The third set was relatively easier to locate and interact with, which were civilians who were caught up in U.S. and Pakistani counterinsurgency violence. And then on the state side, in the U.S., I tried to find and speak to U.S. Counterterrorism operators who had mounted the campaign. And again, there was a lot of secrecy around this, and people were hard to locate because they ended up being in the intelligence community or other parts of the government which are not obviously visible. To outsiders like us. So trying to break into each of these bubbles required different networks, required me to understand, the politics of access you know, along four different verticals, and required me to sort of assure people in you know, dramatically different ways. No amount of preparation could have prepared me for something like that. I kept thinking during the field work and later on that what is it that I could have done beforehand? What is it that I could have read, sort of understand these dynamics? But you know, nothing came to mind.
So just to follow up on that quickly, how did you, as a practical matter, assure the second group, the insurgent group? What strategies were efficacious, and what, I mean, even when they were efficacious, I'm sure they weren't efficacious all the time. So what happened when they didn't believe you?
Right. So in the first few trips, I tried to make contact. It didn't work out. Direct contact was not possible. It's not like you can sort of find a phone number and dial them, and they respond. No, it doesn't happen like that. You have to find interlocutors, middlemen who will vouch for you and who can arrange these meetings for you. And of course, you have to understand the incentives of the middleman. You have to be able to trust the middleman, and in turn, the middlemen have to trust you. The term that journalists use for people who coordinate such interactions is fixers. The first few fixers that I found were, good people, but we just didn't hit it off. And there ended up being problems. But eventually, I converged on a group of people who were very good at their job, and who understood, I think, what I was trying to do. Who understood that I was actually an academic and nothing else, and that the questions I was asking were not related to issues which were super live. In fact, a lot of my questions related to things that had happened, say, a decade back or even more. And once they started seeing that, they vouched for me and they started arranging the meetings and ensured contact. But even then, Despite managing to build some of these relationships, the scale of what I was able to obtain in terms of interactions with members of these militant groups remained small. For the study which has now been published on the U.S. drone war, I interviewed 5 members of Al-Qaeda and 7 members of the Pakistani Taliban, which is a very small sample, and there's a discussion to be had as to, you know, the limits of such a small sample, and you know, what kind of data is best gleaned from such a limited number of interviews. But it took me nearly 10 months to be able to even obtain that kind of scale.
If I may, there's 2 things that kind of popped out to me. One, you used the phrase middlemen several times, so I'm presuming that most of your fixers were male. And second, you kind of reveal a very interesting and dynamic process where you kind of went in, talked to some folks, and then you had to kind of like reconfigure things and then address a new group. But I'm curious as to how you think of what were your first thoughts after your first groupings of conversations? And then you kind of seem like you're changing sides, so to speak. And so then what second thoughts did you have about your original research process, the questions that you were asking and even how you were approaching people?
For sure, yes. These middlemen were men. There were no women involved in arranging these meetings, and we can talk about the local context with more specificity if you're interested. But you know, the second part of your question, upon arrival, I discovered that the Pakistan portion, despite my background in the country and despite the fact that I could, I spoke the language, it was much, much harder than I envisaged it was going to be. For one, people just didn't trust me. This was a major barrier. They viewed me, best case, as an outsider, and worst case, as an agent of the American government. That was the subtext of all interactions and conversations upon arrival, especially. So the security challenge was much deeper, and the security challenge was not just for me, but the people I was coming in contact with, and the people I was asking help from. And so I had to make that the front and center of how I went about my data collection.
Can you help our listeners out in that? I don't mean to interrupt, but can you think of a particular interaction, either a funny one or a tragic one, where the dynamic that you just described was front and center in a way that caused you emotional discomfort or that required resetting an entire relationship, losing a lot of time, something like that?
Sure. So I think let's start with a slightly comical one. I'm reminded of an interaction I had with what I'd call this was a preliminary meeting interaction with an Al Qaeda aligned leader, religious cleric, and I will not say what the location was, but I went in trying to sort of make established contact and see if I could interview him, or he could enable access to more interlocutors. And we sat down, and he thought that I was a student from I was one of the students from the West who had come to him before. In a bid to join the movement, but very quickly my line of questioning sort of went in a very different direction, and I was asking all these political questions, and then midway he stopped me and he said, but what are you doing in your life, wouldn't you want to have you considered your direction? And so he kind of turned the tables on me and engaged in a process of sort of proselytization, and I think this was that made me uncomfortable, and of course I was reminded me of the issue that my committee had highlighted, that don't overcommit on access. And, this was a relationship that I wanted to keep, I valued. But on the other hand, it was becoming increasingly sort of difficult to stay in that conversation. Navigating it became fairly tricky. And this was not just the only time that I found myself trying to convince people to let me talk to them or let me talk to other people that they know, while those people, in fact, wanted me to sort of buy into their, you know, their project, their political, religious project. And yeah, it was initially it was not obvious to me how to get out of those situations.
Mm. So imagine trying to think through the different iterations of kind of awareness and then the process of writing. What would you distill that you kind of like, what did you end up understanding about your initial question, but also about research from doing what you did?
Sure. So my final set of findings related to the U.S. drone war in Pakistan documented the effects of the drone war. So I found a lot of evidence on organizational degradation of the targeted groups, all the ways in which the groups, which had enormous popular support in the region that they were operating in, had resilient organizational structures, all the ways in which those organizations became constrained because of relentless U.S. targeting, as well as the fear of future U.S. targeting. And these findings were, you know, didn't exist in the literature, and I was able to find a lot of information which really showed how those constraints on these organizations worked. There's one finding. The other finding related to the elite politics of two powerful governments, the United States government and the Pakistani government, and how their incentives sort of clashed with each other to produce varied levels of violence. The covert pact between the intelligence agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Pakistani ISI. That revealed to me, something about how counterterrorism campaigning can be resourced and how politics can be a constraint to the kind of counterterrorism resources that are often brought to bear in some of these war theaters. The third major finding related to the issue that initially got me interested, which was civilian mobilization, especially in the face of harm and violence. And here what I discovered was that troublingly, there was serious levels of civilian harm in U.S. campaigning. Lots of civilians were hurt and undermined in the process, and civilians turned to all sorts of coping mechanisms. There was emotional trauma. They also tried to flee the battlefield. But despite that harm, it did not turn into counter-mobilization against the U.S. campaign always, which sort of defied the narrative that existed regarding the campaign, as well as some of our theoretical supposition on counter-mobilization in the face of state violence. And that was, I think that was one of the biggest surprises for me from this work, and which I reflected in the final writing of the study.
So, quick follow-up. I'm curious. You mentioned the covert pact, and so I'm kind of like, did that come from your conversations? I'm like, so which archive are you drawing upon to get the revelations of that? And then you're mentioning the counter mobilization and the coping mechanisms there. Again, I'm also kind of interested in kind of the source material that was used for coming to that conclusion.
Sure. So on the covert pact, that came from conversations and interviews with officials in both Pakistan and the U.S. There were 425 drone strikes in Pakistan. And the question was, why is it that the U.S. is able to carry out drone strikes, and Pakistan, which has a seemingly strong military with air defenses and with lots of airplanes has not done anything to sort of stop this campaigning from happening, despite the fact that it publicly, at least, issues a protest every time a drone strike takes place. And there was some public reporting on this issue as well, but you know, but once I found the right interlocutors on both sides, it appeared that there was a large collaboration as part of which the U.S. and Pakistani governments were sharing intelligence on the conduct of drone strikes. They had also demarcated areas where U.S. drones could fly and carry out surveillance, and of course both governments and the U.S. government played by the limits of that demarcation. They would not cross that demarcated zone, which was called a flight box, and there was constant bargaining between the two sides on potential targets in return for more intelligence, or in return for specific intelligence that the other side was looking for. So these were all facts which were revealed to me in interviews from both sides. I did not rely on information that I only got from one side, because certainly there are incentives to spin.
So it's almost an oral history design, an approach. Was it complemented in any way by actual archival materials or written documents, or was it mostly interviews?
So the research design was a longitudinal tracing, process tracing of the trajectories of the targeted group. And on the side of the independent variable of at least one of the theories, I traced, again, longitudinally, the levels of U.S. campaigning violence, and the determinants of the U.S. violence. In the context of that design, I drew upon oral histories derived from 66 structured interviews. And in addition, I used, there were some declassified documents, there were some leaked documents that came out through, that came out over the years. There was some decent historiography that was, that has been written on the conflict. I also mobilized documents, published and produced by some of the militant actors, both Al-Qaeda and the Pakistan Taliban, that were, I was able to lay my hands on during the course of the fieldwork. But all of this written material was perhaps not more than 30% of the data that I used. I mostly used these materials for the purposes of triangulation. To sort of elucidate a major point that I might have made through the use of the interview-based data, given the stakes of that analytic point, in order to support it or nullify it, I would draw on some of these written materials.
Mm. I hope our listeners appreciate the research design techné that went into that answer. I think that's a really, really revealing and thoughtful way to talk about the process. I want to wrap up with a question that is a little different than the way we normally end. We usually stop by asking, what's the one thing you'd advise others who engage in data collection? But you previewed an answer by saying that you actually can't think of what you wish you knew in advance. So let me actually follow up on a slightly different version of the question. For researchers that are interested in working alongside a narrative that there are very strong domestic constituencies for in the United States, like population-based counterinsurgency, what advice would you give on how to navigate
navigate that space. So it's not like the U.S. military is going to stop being interested in producing population-based counterinsurgency information. It does form a strong narrative, and you, in some ways, have chosen to write against that narrative as you know your project. Do you have any advice for scholars trying to do the same thing in the future?
Right. So narratives, strong pushing back against strong narratives is hard, and trying to construct a project which probes you know such narratives is also difficult. I think the first advice I tell people is to actually seek ground knowledge, and ground knowledge need not come in the through the kind of fieldwork I did. It can come from other sources, other forms of documentation, but it's important to find ground knowledge. The other is to really unpack assumptions of the narratives that exist out there. And instead of trying to critically examine the entire narrative set, I think it's important to pick on or probe specific assumptions. So I went after, I didn't go after, but I critically probed one assumption of the population-centric counterinsurgency enterprise, which was on civilian agency. So civilian behavior, civilian mobilization, especially in response to state harm or harm by insurgents. It's a very simple model. It's a very powerful model. It's a very tempting model, but I felt that the empirical basis to it was weak, and that provided my project sort of a center, I always knew that this is kind of what I was coming back to. This was the organizing principle of the project. So that would be my advice. And the third one would be observe. If you can find the time, if you can spend time in the field initially, just observe. I didn't do enough of it. I was trying to. I got in the process of trying to conduct interviews fairly quickly, but in hindsight, I feel that's not ideal. I recommend scholars to get a sense of the politics of fragile contexts and how they intersect with the national security world through mere observation. I've heard Roger Peterson say that the first step of social science inquiry is not hypothesis formulation or data collection. It's observation. It's observing the social phenomena. And many a times, sitting this afar, observation is extremely challenging, if not impossible, good observation. So I strongly encourage researchers to just do that, which would obviously reveal the challenges that they're likely to encounter.
Interesting. It would also reveal the resource capabilities of the scholar itself, right? Just being able to go someplace and have the luxury of observation is somewhat of an elite enterprise. And actually, unless you're from the place, right, which becomes fascinating. I remember Gandhi, as he was coming back from South Africa, was told when he was going back to India to kind of get started, folks were just like, just observe for a while. Just go see and experience the country again before you begin anything. And I think for like a year or something like that, he just kind of like walked the country and observed. But I think that's a fabulous place for us to end. But thank you very much for a fantastic episode, and look forward to seeing all the rest that you do. And we'll make sure to provide links with regards to everything that you mentioned in this particular episode. But thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Asfianda.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was a fun conversation.
Hello. Thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive and for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future. Please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.